Ours.
Are you serious?
It was our car he peered into.
Where?
The East River, at 34th Street. Hemingway said,
You know guns, right? Being a Marine and all?
Son of a Marine, Reacher said. It was the right gun.
It's pitch dark.
The moon and the stars, and the water.
Hemingway ducked down another inch and looked across Reacher at Chrissy.
Did you see it too?
Chrissy said.
No.
How come?
I wasn't looking.
Hemingway said.
I don't know what to do.
Okay, let's say we have a confirmed sighting, but so what? We already know the Son of Sam is in New York. That's the point of the guy. It adds no new information. You'd need something more. You'd need to know who he is.
Do you?
No, Reacher said. But I know what he used to be.
They parked on Bleecker, intending to walk back and join Hemingway in her doorway hideout. But suddenly Bleecker had people on it, some of them in groups, some of them in pairs, some of those groups and pairs carrying stuff too heavy for comfort, and therefore consequently looking for alternative modes of transportation, such as small hatchback cars, each one apparently ideal for hauling a large television. Reacher and Chrissy were a yard out of the Chevette, with the doors closed but not locked, when the staring match started. Two guys, staggering under an enormous box, with Sony written on it upside down. They came in a straight line, eyeballing the Chevette all the way, and Reacher said,
Keep walking, guys.
The guy on the left was a shadowy, grunting figure, and he said,
Suppose we don't.
Then I'll kick your butt and steal your television.
Suppose you drive us.
Just keep walking, Reacher said.
They didn't. They eased the box carefully to the ground and stood up again, breathing deep, two dark figures in the dark. Even from 6 feet away, it was hard to make out detail, but their hands hadn't gone to their pockets yet, which was a good sign. It meant any upcoming combat was likely to be unarmed, which was reassuring. Reacher had grown up in a culture of extreme violence, it being hard to describe the U.S. Marine Corps any other way, and he had taken its lessons on board, with the result that he hadn't lost a fight in more than 10 years, against Corps kids from the same culture, and against rivalrous local youth all around the world, who liked to think the U.S. military was nothing special, and to try to prove it by proxy, usually unsuccessfully. Two punks on a blacked-out New York City street were unlikely to prove an unprecedented problem unless they had knives or guns, which was unknowable at that point. The guy on the right said,
Maybe we'll take the girl with us. Maybe we'll have ourselves some fun.
The guy on the left said,
Just give us the keys and no one gets hurt.
Which was the moment of decision. Surprise was always good. Delay was always fatal. Guys who let a situation unfold in its own good time were just stockpiling problems for themselves. Reacher ran at the left-hand guy, two choppy steps, like an infielder charging a grounder, and he didn't slow down. He ran right through the guy, leading with his forearm held horizontal, jerking his elbow into the guy's face. And as soon as he felt the guy's nose burst open, he stamped down and reversed direction around the box and went after the second guy, who flinched away and took Reacher's charging weight flat in the back. The guy pitched forward like he had been hit by a truck, and Reacher kicked him in the head, and the guy lay still. Reacher checked their pockets. No knives, no guns, which was usually the case. But it had been their choice. They could have kept on walking. He hauled the right-hand guy next to the left-hand guy, close together, shoulder to shoulder, and he picked up the heavy box like a strong man in the circus, struggling and tottering, and he took two short steps and dropped it on their heads, from waist height. Chrissy said, "Why did you do that?"
"Rules," Reacher said. "Winning ain't enough. The other guy has to know he lost."
"Is that what they teach you in the Marine Corps?"
"More or less."
"They'll wreck the car when they wake up."
"They won't. They'll throw up and crawl home, by which time you'll be long gone anyway."
So Chrissy locked up, and they walked back through the heat to where Hemingway was waiting on Carmine.
Reacher said, "No progress?"
Hemingway said, "Not yet."
"Maybe we should go recruit someone. There are plenty of people on Bleecker."
"That would be suborning a felony."
"Means to an end."
"Tell me what you meant about the guy with the bulldog."
"Can you use it?"
"Depends what it is."
"It was dark," Reacher said, "obviously."
"But?"
"He was in his mid-20s, I would say. Medium height, heavy in the chest and shoulders, quite pale, with wavy hair that wouldn't lie down."
"Carrying a 44 bulldog?"
"Most bulldogs are 44s, but I don't have X-ray vision."
"How far away was he?"
20 feet at one point."
"How long were you eyeballing him?"
20 seconds, maybe."
20 seconds at 20 feet?
Hemingway said. "In a blackout?"
"That's a tough sell. I bet there have been 1,000 reports tonight. People freak out in the dark."
"He was a trained man," Reacher said.
"Trained how?"
"The way he moved through the available cover. He's ex-military. He's had infantry training."
"So have lots of guys. You ever heard of Vietnam?"
"He's too young. This guy was of age 6 or 7 years ago. The draft was winding down. You had to be pretty unlucky. And I don't think he was ever in combat. I've seen lots of people back from Vietnam. They're different. This guy was all theory and training. Second nature, for sure. Pretty slick. But he had never lived or died by it. I can guarantee that. And I don't think he was a Marine. They're different, too. I think he was Army. And I think he's been in Korea. It was like a fingerprint. I think he did basic and infantry with the urban specialization. And I think he served in Seoul, like a particular combination. That's how he looked. I see it all the time. You ever been there? Well, Seoul teaches you to move a certain way. But he's been out at least 2 years because of the hair, and he's had time to get a bit heavy. I think he volunteered at 18 or 19, and I think he served a 3-year hitch. That was my impression anyway."
"That's one hell of a detailed impression."
"You could offer it as a filter. They could see if any persons of interest match up."
"It was 20 seconds in the pitch dark.
What else have they got?"
Maybe I could."
"Suppose it worked. Suppose they get the guy. Would that be good for you?"
"Well, of course it would."
"So what's the downside?"
"Sounding desperate and pathetic."
"Your call."
"You should try it," Chrissy said. "Someone needs to catch the guy."
Hemingway said nothing. They waited, all crammed together in the doorway opposite Criselli's place, with absolutely nothing happening. They heard sirens and snatches of conversation from people passing by on Bleecker, like headline news. It was now only 90 degrees. The lights had gone out at Shea in the bottom of the sixth, with the Mets trailing the Cubs by 2-1. Subway riders had spent scary hours trapped underground, but were slowly making their way back to the surface. Cars were using chains and ropes to tear the shutters off stores. Even Brooks Brothers on Madison had been looted. Crown Heights and Bushwick were on fire. Cops had been hurt, and arrests had been made. Then the last of the passers-by moved on, and Carmine went quiet again, and the clock in Reacher's head ticked around towards midnight. He said to Chrissy,
"I'll walk you back to your car. Your friends will be waiting."
She said, "Are you staying here?"
"Might as well. I already missed my bus."
"Do you think the roads are open?"
"Wide open. They want people to leave."
"Why?"
"Fewer mouths to feed here."
"Makes sense," Chrissy said. They walked together to the corner and around it, where the Chevette waited undisturbed. The two guys were still laid out in the roadway under the box, like a cartoon accident. They were still breathing. Reacher said,
"Want me to ride with you?"
"No," Chrissy said. "We go back alone. That's part of the deal."
"You know how to go?"
"Up on 6th and across on 4th, and then it's right there."
"Roger that."
"Take care, okay?"
"I will," Reacher said.
"You too.
I'll never forget you."
"You will."
"Check back next year. See if I have."
"Okay. Let's see who remembers. Same night, same place. Deal?"
"I'll be there," Reacher said.
She got into the car, and she eased away from the tangle of limbs behind her, and she made the left on 6th. And she waved through her open window, and then she was gone. Hemingway said, "I'm going to put it in the system. Your impression, I mean. That's the smart play here. They'll ignore it, of course, but it will be in the record. I can say, 'Told you so,' afterwards, if you're right. That's always worth a point or two, sometimes more. Being right afterwards can be a wonderful thing."
"It's a filter," Reacher said. "That's all. It's about efficiency. But I still need Criselli. The Son of Sam wouldn't get you out of jail. I need Criselli."
"Why?"
"Because he burns me up."
"You ever read a book called Moby Dick?" "Okay, I get it. And I admit it. Criselli is my great white whale. I'm obsessed. But what can I do about it? What could anyone with a whale pressing on her head?"
"Is that how you feel? Like you have a whale pressing on your head?"
"That's exactly how I feel."
"Then let's trade," Reacher said.
"What for what?"
"I need a ride out of town."
"When?"
"As soon as possible. I'm sure my brother's worrying about me, which I'm sure is hard on the old guy. I need to put him out of his misery."
"I'm not a taxi dispatcher."
"You have a car."
"I'm not a chauffeur either."
"You could lend it to me."
"How would I get it back?"
"I don't know."
"Do you even have a license?"
"Not exactly."
"No deal,"
she said.
"Okay,"
Reacher said. "What were you going to do for me?"
"Suppose an unknown suspect broke into Criselli's place and you got a look inside. Then the unknown suspect fled, but you were too busy securing the scene to chase him."
I've been waiting 2 hours for that to happen, but it hasn't.
I could do it.
You're 16 years old.
How is that relevant?
Entrapment is bad enough. Entrapment with minors is probably worse.
Who would ever know, apart from you and me?
I have no way of getting you a ride out of town.
Reacher paused a beat and said,
Maybe we should refine the plan.
What plan?
Hemingway said.
We don't have a plan.
Probably better if it's not you who makes the discovery. It could look like a personal vendetta. It could give Criselli's lawyers something to work with. Probably better if it's not even the FBI at all. Better if it's the NYPD, don't you think? An independent agency, with no axe to grind. If they discover a dope dealer and his stash in their city, then it's out there. It can't be denied. It is what it is. Your people will have to hush up their deal, and they'll have to admit you were right all along, and you can turn your review procedure into a medal ceremony. The NYPD is busy tonight. They have a narcotics division, surely. Make the call ahead of time. Get a sense of how long they're going to be, and we'll try to time it exactly right. I'll bust in, you hang back and keep an eye on things for a minute until the cops show up, and then we'll both slip away, and you can drive me north. Meanwhile, the NYPD will be building your case for you, and by the time you're back in town, your bosses will be rolling out the red carpet.
How far north do you want to go?
West Point. It's up the river a ways.
I know where it is.
So do we have a deal?
Hemingway didn't answer. Hemingway finally agreed about 30 minutes later, close to 1 o'clock in the morning. But the plan went wrong immediately. First, they couldn't find a working phone. They searched up and down Carmine, and they tried the corner with 7th Avenue, and the corner with Bleecker, and 6th Avenue. And every payphone they found was silent. They didn't know if it was the result of the blackout or just the general abject state of the city. Reacher figured the phone company had its own electricity, in its own wires, so he was all in favor of carrying on the search. But Hemingway was reluctant to foray further in case she missed something over at Caselli's place, so she walked back to the doorway on Carmine, and Reacher went on alone, across 6th. And on the corner between Minetta Street and Minetta Lane, he found a phone with a dial tone. It was too dark to see the numbers, so he dialed by feel, 0 for the operator, and he waited a long time before she answered. He asked for the NYPD's 6th precinct, and waited again even longer, before the call was picked up and a voice barked,
Yes.
Reacher said, I want to report illegal narcotics in the West Village.
The voice said,
What?
There's a storeroom full of drugs on Carmine, just been bust open.
Any dead bodies?
No.
Anyone currently in the act of getting killed?
No.
Fire?
No.
The voice said,
Then stop wasting my time.
And the phone went dead. Reacher hung up and hustled back, sweating, 90 degrees at 1 in the morning, and relayed the news to Hemingway, who nodded in the dark and said,
We should have seen that coming. I guess they're all hands on deck right now.
We might have to use your own people.
Forget it. They wouldn't take my call.
Reacher said,
Still got your little sister's cassette recorder?
It's my cassette recorder.
Still got it?
Why?
Maybe I can get him to boast on the tape.
You?
Same principle. You can't let this look like a vendetta.
I can't let you. You and him, face to face? I have a conscience.
What's he gonna do to me?
Beat you to death?
He's a made man, Reacher said. He has soldiers, which means he tells other people to do the heavy lifting, which means he's out of practice. He's all hat and no cattle. He's got nothing. We already saw that on Waverly. Any 12-year-old in the Philippines could eat his lunch.
Is this a Marine Corps thing?
I'm not a Marine.
How would you get in?
I assume the church behind him is locked.
Tonight for sure, if not every night.
I'll figure something out. How would the military do it? Marines or Army?
Army.
They'd call in artillery support, or air to ground.
Marines?
They'd start a fire, probably. That usually brings them out real fast.
You can't do that.
I'm not a Marine, Reacher said again.
He looked across the street. The second-story windows were dark, obviously, which meant Criselli could be right there, watching, but without seeing much. A man in a dark room watching a lit street had an advantage. A man in a dark room watching a dark street might as well have saved himself the eye strain. Reacher crossed the dark street, to the double doors. He put his fingertips on them. They felt like sandpaper, 50-year-old paint, plus 50 years of smoke and grime and dust. He tapped, first with his fingernails, then, gently, with his knuckles. The wood felt old and thick and solid, like it had been shipped 100 years before from some ancient forest out west. He slid his palms across the surface until he found the Judas Gate. Same paint, same grime, same wood. He felt for the hinges and didn't find any. He felt for the lock and rubbed it with his thumb. It seemed to be a small round Yale, worn brass, probably as old as the paint. He headed back to Hemingway. He said, "The doors are probably 2 or 3 inches thick, and the Judas Gate is all of a piece, all quality lumber, probably hard as a rock by now. Then maybe the army way is the only way. Maybe not. The Judas Gate opens inward. The lock is an old Yale, put in maybe 50 years ago. I'm guessing they didn't chase out a void in the door. Not in wood that hard, not back then. People weren't so uptight about security. I bet the lock is surface-mounted on the back like an old house. The tongue is in a little surface-mounted box. 2 screws is all. There will be another door out of the yard, into the building. Might have a newer lock. Then I'll knock and rely on charm. I can't let you do this. It's the least I can do. I screwed you up before. You might have gotten something. You were going to take that slap and keep him talking. He had already found the wire, but he's arrogant. He's got an ego. He might have carried on regardless, just to taunt you. That's what I was hoping. Then let me put it right." Reacher turned around and lifted his shirt and bared his back to Hemingway. He felt hot fingers scrabbling at his waistband, gapping it out, fitting the plastic box behind the elastic on his shorts. Then he felt the scrape of a wire, and her hand burrowed up his back, under his shirt, to his shoulder blade, and then on over the top, a curious vertical embrace, her breath on his neck. And then she turned him around again to face her, and her other hand went up the front of his shirt, to find the microphone, to pass it from hand to hand, and to pull it down into place. She stopped with it trapped against his chest, and she kept her hand there, flat, nothing between her palm and his skin except the small pebble of technology. She said, "I put it in my bra, but you don't have one."
"Imagine that," Reacher said.
"There's nothing to keep it in place." Reacher felt an immediate film of sweat between his chest and her hand. He said,
"Got a Band-Aid in your purse?"
"You're a smart kid," she said. And she went into a one-hand, two-elbows contortion to root through her bag, and as she craned her neck to look downward into it, her forehead touched his lips, just briefly, like a kiss. Her hair was limp, but it smelled like strawberries. She jerked her bag back up on her shoulder and held up something that crackled slightly. A Band-Aid, he assumed, still in its hygienic wrapper. He took it from her and peeled it open in the space between their faces. Then, in turn, she took it back from him one-handed and used it to tape the microphone in the trench between his chest muscles. She smoothed the adhesive. Once. Twice. And then she took her hands out from under his shirt and pulled it down into place. She put her palm on his chest, like Cresselli had put his on hers, pressing hard on the damp cotton. And she said,
"He'll find it."
"Don't worry," Reacher said. "If he puts his hands on me, I'll beat him to death."
Hemingway said nothing.
Reacher said, "That's a Marine Corps thing."
The darkness didn't help. It didn't help at all. Reacher lined up on the opposite curb, like a sprinter at the start of a race, but he couldn't exactly see where he was heading. Adjustments were going to be necessary as he ran. He took off, slow and clumsy, partly because of the dark, partly because he was a terrible runner, with long, lumbering strides. And 3 paces out he saw the doors, and 2 paces out he saw the Judas Gate, and with 1 pace to go he saw its lock, and he launched his leading foot in a scything kick, slightly across his body, and he smashed his heel as close to the small Yale circle as he could get with all his 220 pounds behind it, multiplied significantly by the final acceleration of his foot and by the fact that his whole bulk was moving briskly, if not exactly fast. But it was enough. The Judas Gate exploded inward, with what felt like no resistance at all, and Reacher hurtled through the resulting blank rectangle into a space so dark he could make out nothing at all. There was the feel of cobblestones under his feet, and the sour smell of garbage, and sheer dark walls rising on his left and his right and ahead. He felt his way along the right-hand wall to the back corner of the yard, where he found a door. Ridged glass above, a panel below, a smooth steel handle, and a lock that felt newer. The glass was probably tempered and reinforced with wire. The lock was probably chased into the door and the jamb, a whole different proposition. He waited to see if Cresselli would come down and open it himself, which he might. He must have heard the crash of the Judas Gate. But he didn't come down. Reacher waited 3 minutes, breathing hard, stretching his eyes wide open, willing them to see something. But they didn't. He stepped up to the door again and traced its shape with his hands. The panel below the glass would be the weak spot. Plywood, probably, maybe 3/8 thick, painted, retained in the frame by quarter-round moldings. Reacher was wearing shoes he had bought in the London airport 2 deployments ago, stout British things with welts and toe caps as hard as steel. They had bust heads and kneecaps already that night. Plywood wasn't going to be a major problem. He stepped back and poked forward with his toe to fix his target in his mind. Then he kicked out. Bang! Bang! Concentrating on the corners of the panel, viciously and noisily, until the wood splintered and the moldings came loose. Then he stopped and listened. No sound from inside the building. Which was a bitch. Reacher would have preferred to meet Cresselli face to face on the ground floor. He didn't relish heading up a flight of stairs towards an alert opponent at the top. He waited some more. No sound. He squatted down with his back against the doorframe and punched out the panel with his elbow, until it folded inward like a miniature door itself, hinged on a few surviving nails. Then he twisted around and put his arm and his shoulder through the hole and reached up and scrabbled for the knob, which he found easily enough. He had arms like a gorilla. Every childhood photograph of him featured 6 inches of bare wrist at the end of every sleeve. The door opened, and he struggled upright and backed off a yard, just in case. But there was no sound inside. Cresselli didn't come out. There was nothing to see. Just darkness. The inside air smelled hot and stale. Reacher stepped in, to what felt like a narrow lobby with a tiled floor. He slid his feet ahead, one after the other, and felt a bottom stair. There was a handrail on the left. The opposite wall was less than 3 feet away. It was painted, and damp with condensation. Reacher went up the stairs, his right hand out in front of him, his left holding the handrail. There was a yard-wide half-landing, and then the stairs dog-legged and continued upward. At the top was dusty, superheated air, and a 6x3 upstairs lobby with a sticky carpet and a door at each end, a front room and a back room. Under the back room door was a bar of faint, warm light. Reacher stared at it, like a thirsty man in the desert might stare at a cold drink. It was a candle, probably. It was the first man-made light he had seen in more than 3 hours. He put his hand under his shirt at the back and pushed the button Hemingway had showed him. "It's red," she had said, which hadn't helped, because he didn't have eyes in the back of his head, and it was pitch dark anyway. So he had learned it by feel. He tapped his chest so that a thump could mark the start of the recording. Then he put his hand on the doorknob. Reacher twisted the knob and pushed the door. One, two, fast and hard, and he stepped into a room lit by a guttering candle. The flame danced in the rush of air. The room was a 20x20 space with a dark window in the back wall and a row of old-fashioned safes on the left, like something out of a black-and-white Western movie about bank robbers. And on the right, there was a row of file cabinets and a desk. And sitting at the desk, in a leather reclining chair, was Griselli. The chair was pushed out and turned sideways, so that he was sitting face-on to the door. He had a gun in his hand. It was a Colt M1911, a 45 automatic, standard military issue for 66 years, hence the model number. It looked a little scratched and battered. It was all lit up by the candle which was on the desk, welded to a china plate by a pool of its own wax. A standard household item, a few cents at the hardware store, but it felt as bright as the sun. Griselli said,
"You."
Reacher said nothing. Griselli had shed his jacket and pulled down his tie, but his shirt was still wet. He said,
"I was expecting Hemingway. What are you tonight, her knight in shining armor? Is she sending a boy to do a man's job?"
"Is he armed?" Reacher had asked. "Not in the city," Hemingway had said. "He can't afford to be." Not applicable inside his own premises, apparently, which was a bitch. Reacher looked at the row of safes. There were six of them, shoulder to shoulder, each one about a yard wide and 6 feet tall. They had keyholes, not combination locks. The door on the far end was wide open, and the void behind it was empty. Their armory, Reacher guessed, for dire emergencies, like that very night. Clearly, Griselli's soldiers were all armed, all out on the street, all ensuring protection.
"You have a gun,"
Reacher said, for the tape.
"I'm defending my property,"
Griselli said.
"This is your place?"
"I'm not a common burglar."
Reacher took a step. The Colt's muzzle rose a degree to track him. Reacher asked,
"Is your name on the title?"
"I'm not that stupid."
"Then this isn't your place."
"Only technically. Believe me, kid, everything you see here is mine."
"What's in the safes?"
"Inventory."
"Yours?"
"I already told you."
"I need to hear it in short, simple words."
"Why?"
"We could do business."
"Business?"
"That's what I said."
"You and me?"
"If you're smart," Reacher said.
"You broke down my door."
"Would you have let me in if I had knocked?"
"What kind of business could we do, you and I?"
"You're using the New Jersey Turnpike and the Holland Tunnel, which means you're getting supplied out of Miami, all the way up I-95, which means you're paying over the odds. And you're losing some to unreliable mules, and you're losing some to routine New Jersey State Police patrols. I could help you with all of that."
"How?"
"I bring stuff in direct from the Far East, on military planes. No scrutiny. My dad's a Marine officer."
"What kind of stuff?"
"Anything you want."
"What kind of price, kid?"
"Show me what you got and tell me what you paid. Then I'll break your heart."
"You hurt two of my men."
Reacher said, "I hope so. I need you to understand, you do not mess with me."
He took another step. The Colt's muzzle rose another degree. Reacher said,
"Are you buying from Martinez?"
"I never heard of Martinez."
"Then you're way over the odds already. Who are you buying from?"
"The Medellin boys."
"I could save you 40%.
Griselli said,
"I think you're full of shit. I think this is a Hemingway stunt."
"You shut her down."
"For which I paid good money, for which I expected a durable result. Anything else is liable to make me angry."
"This has nothing to do with Hemingway."
"Pull up your shirt."
"Why?"
"I want to see the wire before I shoot you."
Reacher thought, unregistered guns, a deceptive real estate title, a straight-up reference to the Medellin cartel out of Colombia, and a straight-up reference to bribery. The tape had enough. He took a deep, deep breath and put his hands on the hem of his T-shirt. Then he jerked forward from the waist. And blew out the candle. The room went from softly glowing to blacker than the Earl of Hell's winter coat, all in a split second, and Reacher blundered straight ahead, forcing passage between Cresselli's chair and the desk, and Cresselli whipped the Colt around in the same general direction and fired, but he missed by a mile, and the muzzle flash backlit him perfectly, like a photographer's strobe, so Reacher picked his spot and slammed a straight right into the back of his neck. Right where soft turns to hard, and Cresselli pitched head first out of the chair and landed on his knees. Reacher groped for the chair and lifted it high by the armrests and slammed it down on Cresselli's back. He heard the sound of steel on linoleum as the Colt skittered away, and he brushed the chair aside and groped and patted blindly until he found the collar of Cresselli's shirt, which he bunched in his left hand while he pounded away with his right, short roundhouse punches to the side of Cresselli's head, his ear, his jaw, 1, 2, 3, 4 vicious clubbing blows, until he felt the steam go out of the guy, whereupon he reached forward and grabbed his wrists and yanked them up behind his back, high and painful, and he clamped them together in his left hand. Human handcuffs, a party trick perfected years before, enabled by the freakish strength in his fingers, from which no one had ever escaped, not even his brother, who was of equal size, or his father, who was smaller but stronger. He hauled Cresselli to his feet and slapped at his pants pockets until he heard the jingle of keys. Cresselli got his second wind and started struggling hard, so Reacher turned him a little sideways and quieted him down again with a pile driver jab to the kidney. Then he fished out the keys and held them in his right hand, and asked, "Where's your book of matches?" Cresselli said,
"You're gonna die, kid."
"Obviously," Reacher said. "No one lives forever."
"I mean tonight, kid."
Reacher separated a key by feel and pressed the point high on Cresselli's cheek. He said,
"If so, you won't see it happen. I'll take your eyes out first."
"Matches in the desk drawer," Cresselli said.
Reacher turned him again and slammed a short right to his stomach to fold him over and keep him preoccupied, and he walked him, bent over and puking, to the desk, and he used his free hand to rattle open the drawers and to root around, all by feel. There was all kinds of stuff in the drawers, staplers, pens, rolls of scotch tape, some in dispensers, pencils, paper clips, and a book of matches, a little limp and damp. Using a matchbook one-handed was practically impossible, so Reacher turned Cresselli towards the window wall and let go of his wrists and shoved him hard and used the resulting few undisturbed seconds to detach a match and strike it, all fizzing and flaring in the dark, and to light the candle with it once again, by which time Cresselli was shaping up for a charge, so Reacher stepped towards him and dropped him with a right to the solar plexus just as the room bloomed back to its former cozy glow. A solar plexus was worth at least a minute, Reacher thought, and he used that minute to cross the room and pick up the Colt, and to dump its magazine, and to eject the shell from its chamber, and to pick up the chair, and to set it back on its casters, and to turn it, just so, and to find the Scotch tape, and to pick the guy up, and to dump him in the chair, and to start taping his wrists to the frame. Scotch tape was weaker than duct tape, but Reacher made up for it with length, around and around, right hand, left hand, until the guy looked like he had two broken wrists in casts made of some kind of new see-through yellowish plaster. Then came his ankles. In all, Reacher used 6 whole rolls of tape, and after that there was no way the guy was moving. Then Hemingway came in the door. She looked at the candle first, and then at Criselli. Reacher said, "He admits on tape, everything here is his." She said, "I heard a gunshot. He missed. It was about 20 degrees off on the port side. I was worried. It's the Godfather should worry. This is a made man."
"What did he say on the tape?"
"Take it out of my pants and listen for yourself."
Which she did. Reacher felt the hot, quick fingers again, and the weird embrace under his shirt as the microphone was passed from hand to hand. Then she clicked and waited, and clicked again. And a thin, tinny version of Griselli's voice filled the room, taking responsibility for everything in it, admitting to the Medellin connection, admitting to the bribe, and hinting at the size of it. She said, "You have his keys?" Reacher said, "Right here in my hand." "Open the safe doors." Which he did, starting next to the empty armory, working away from the window, until all of the safes stood open. All of them were full of smooth-packed, plastic-wrapped bricks, some brown or green in color, most white or yellow. She said, "Can you get his keys back in his pocket?" He did, and said, "What next?" "Does his phone work?" He tried it, and said, "Yes." She gave him a number and said, "It's our internal, credible threat hotline." He called it in, the exact address, without giving his name, and then the call ended, and she said, "Their response time will be more than 5 minutes, but less than 10. She put her plastic cassette recorder on the floor near Criselli's feet. She said, "We should go. My car is not close." Reacher said, "Is this enough?" She said, "More than enough. Medellin is toxic, and the evidence is right here. It's a photograph, Reacher. This is a photogenic prosecution. It doesn't matter who he bribed. No one is ever going to say a word against this one. It's a tidal wave."
"One last thing," Reacher said, and he turned back to Criselli, and he said, "Slapping women is not permitted. You're supposed to be a man, not a pussy."
Criselli said nothing. Reacher raised his hand.
"How would you like it?"
Criselli said,
"You wouldn't hit a guy tied to a chair."
Reacher said,
"Watch me,"
and slapped the guy in the face, hard, a real crack, wet or not, and the chair went up on its side legs and balanced and balanced and tottered, and then thumped down on its side, with its casters spinning and Griselli's head bouncing around like a pinball. Then they hit the bricks, and Hemingway's prediction of 5 to 10 came true, in that they saw hurrying cars about 6 minutes out, and then a pair of heavy trucks, a lot of firepower, and why not for a credible threat? Hemingway's car was 4 blocks away on Sullivan. It was the mid-blue Granada Reacher had seen before, with the vinyl roof and the toothy grill. He said,
"You sure this gets you off the hook?"
She said, "Count on it, kid. Being right afterwards is a wonderful thing."
"Then give me a ride out of town."
"I should stay. Give them time to grieve. Give them time to figure out how it's really their own idea. I've seen this shit before. All organizations are the same. You need to lay low for a day. You need to be out of the spotlight." "West Point?"
"Take the thruway and a Tappan Zee."
"How long will I be gone?"
"They're gonna roll out the red carpet, Jill. Just give them time to find it first."
They drove a long, long time in the dark. And then they hit neighborhoods with power, with traffic lights and street lights, and the occasional lit room. Billboards were bright, and the familiar nighttime background of orange diamonds on black velvet lay all around. Hemingway said, "I have to stop and call." Reacher said,
"Call who?"
"The office."
"Why?"
"I have to know whether it worked."
"I'm sure it did.
I have to know.
So stop.
We could get a cup of coffee.
It's 100 degrees.
Oh, it's got to be less than 90 now.
Still too hot for coffee.
She pulled over to the right-hand lane, and then she took an exit road to what Reacher imagined was a superpower version of the standard type of highway facility, with multiple restrooms and gas big enough for trucks, and motel rooms for weary drivers, and not just something to eat, but a restaurant big enough to feed Syracuse, and payphones. There was a long line, right outside the restaurant's extensive and brightly lit windows. Hemingway used one and hung up smiling and said,
"It's working. Criselli has been arrested."
He asked,
"How's the whale?"
She said,
"The whale is gone."
She looked dazed for a second, and then she got a big smile on her face, and they hugged, with some kind of relief and ecstasy in her tight embrace. Reacher felt bony ribs and the flutter of her heart. It was beating fast. Then she moved to another phone and dialed another number, and she gave her name, and she dictated a long report about a confirmed sighting of the Son of Sam, made by what she called a confidential informant, who had what she called extensive military experience. Then she hung up again and said,
"This will sound crazy, but I really want to rent a room, just to take a shower."
Reacher said,
"Doesn't sound crazy to me."
"Does it matter what time you get there?"
"Not within a shower or two."
"So let's do it."
"Both of us?"
"It's a mutual benefit."
"Who goes first?"
"I go first."
"Okay," Reacher said.
She paid at the motel office, a visible wad of bills, what Reacher figured must be the whole night rate, and she came back with a key to room 15, which was located way in back, the last cabin before the woods. Reacher said,
"Do you want me to wait in the car?"
Hemingway said,
"You can wait in the room."
So they went in together, and found a hot, stale space with the usual features. Hemingway checked the bathroom and came out with a bunch of towels and said,
"These are yours."
And then she went back in and closed the door. Reacher waited on the bed until she came out again much later, all hot and pink and wrapped in towels. She said,
"Your turn."
And she crossed the room, a little unsteady on her feet, as if overcome by steam or exhaustion. He said,
"You okay?"
She said,
"I'm fine."
He paused a beat, and then he went in the bathroom, which was as steamy as a sauna, with the mirror all fogged up, showing the swipes and arcs where the maid had cleaned it. He stripped and hung his limp clothes on a hook, and he started the shower and set it warm, and he stepped into the tub and pulled the curtain. He soaped up and used the shampoo, and he scrubbed and rinsed, and he stood under the warm stream for an extra minute, and then he got out. Getting dry was not really an option, given the temperature and the humidity. He moved the moisture around his skin with a towel, and he put his old clothes back on, damp and snagging, and he combed his hair with his fingers. Then he stepped out in a billow of moisture. Jill Hemingway was flat on her back on the bed. At first he thought she was sleeping. Then he saw her eyes were open. He took her wrist and felt her pulse. Nothing there. He tried her neck. Nothing there. Her eyes stared up at him, blank and sightless. Medical reasons. Her heart, he thought. No doubt a cause of concern. He had felt it racing and fluttering. He had seen her stagger. He crossed the room and stared out the window. Still the dead of night. Through the trees, he could see lights from cars on the highway. He could hear their sound, faint and constant. He crossed back to the bed and checked again, wrist, neck. Nothing. He stepped out to the lot and closed the door behind him and hiked over to the line of payphones outside the restaurant. He chose one at random and dialed the number she had given him for the internal hotline. He reported her death, said it looked natural, and gave the location. He didn't give his name. Jill Hemingway, R.I.P. She died young, but she had a smile on her face. He walked on to the gas plaza, past the car pumps, past the truck pumps, to the exit road. He kept one foot in the traffic lane and rested the other on the curb, and he stuck out his thumb. The second car to pass by picked him up. It was a Chevrolet Chevette, baby blue, but it wasn't Chrissy's. It was a whole different car altogether, driven by a guy in his 20s who was heading for Albany. He let Reacher out at an early exit, and a dairyman in a pickup truck took him onward, and then he walked a mile to the turn that led up to the academy. He ate in a roadhouse, and he walked another mile, and he saw West Point's lights up ahead, far in the distance. He figured no one would reveille before 0600, which was still 2 hours away, so he found a bus bench and lay down to sleep. The day after the blackout, power was restored in part of Queens at 7 in the morning, followed by part of Manhattan shortly afterwards. By lunchtime, half the city was back. By 11 in the evening, the whole city was back. The outage had been caused by a maintenance error, a lightning strike in Buchanan, New York. Part of the long summer storm Reacher had seen in the distance had tripped a circuit breaker, but a loose locking nut had prevented the breaker from closing again immediately, as it was designed to do. As a consequence, a cascade of trips and overloads had rolled south over the next hour until the whole city was out. By morning, more than 1,600 stores had been looted. More than 1,000 fires had been set, more than 500 cops had been injured, and more than 4,000 people had been arrested, all because of a loose nut. 28 days after the blackout, the son of Sam was captured outside his home on Pine Street, Yonkers, New York, less than 4 miles from Sarah Lawrence College. His year-long killing spree was over. His name was David Berkowitz, and he was 24 years old. He was carrying his Charter Arms bulldog in a paper sack. He confessed to his crimes immediately, and he confirmed he had volunteered for the U.S. Army at age 18, and had served 3 years, partly inside the continental U.S., but mostly in South Korea.